This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today is the official federal observance of Veterans Day. So we wanted to pay tribute to the men and women who answered the call of duty to fight a war that was raging in both Europe and the Pacific. Today, we salute our World War II veterans and those who do their best to make sure that what these men and women did some 70 years ago will never be forgotten. We're joined by two of Michigan's World War II veterans. Both men fought their war in the skies. Bill Rosenai of Bloomfield Hills was a navigator on a B-17, the Flying Fortress, in Europe. Murray Cotter of Beverly Hills was a bombardier on a B-24, the Liberator, in the Pacific. And Brad Ziegler is a freelance photographer who's been photographing Michigan's World War II vets, particularly as they took special honor flights to visit the nation's World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C. Welcome to all of you. Bill Rosenai, I want to start with you. Just how old were you when you joined the Army?
18.
Right out of high school.
2 weeks out of high school, I went down to the Union Station and was on a troop train off to war, but I had to be trained. I got through the training when I was 19, and the interesting thing was after I finished the navigation school and graduated, they sent me to Texas, and I met my B-17 crew. And we trained with the B-17, which is the first time I was ever on one. And it was quite a thrill to be on a B-17. And then we went to Lincoln, Nebraska. They gave us a brand new plane. And they said, I want you to take it to England. And I was 19.
Wow.
And I said, it's kind of hard to believe when I see my grandchildren. Being 19 years old, flying across the Atlantic all by yourself at night, you know, it was quite a thrill. But you just did it. You thought that was the thing to do.
What drew you to decide, you know what, I'm going up in the air? What drew you to join a flight crew?
I always liked airplanes. I was drafted, actually, when I turned 18, but they let me go finish high school, which was a few more months after my 18th birthday. And I thought, gee, it would be nice to get it, rather than being in the Army or Navy or Marines and so forth, if I could get something connected with flying. So at that time, they had lowered the restrictions for the Army Air Corps. At first, you had to be 20 with 2 years of college. But the casualty rate was so high, they lowered it to 18 in high school education. But you had to pass a lot of tests to get in. And so I applied for that. I was fortunate to get what they call the Aviation Cadet Program.
And there you became a navigator.
Yeah.
And when did you officially begin combat missions?
The first mission was on December 7th, 1944. It was about a week before the Battle of the Bulge. So just after I got started, we started to support that action, which is essentially we had to get in and when the weather cleared to destroyed the replacements of the German army. We were sort of in the Germany, trying to knock out whatever we could. And literally, it worked because after 6 weeks, they literally ran out of gas. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Germans could not proceed, and they had to back off. So we felt we did our job by, you know, destroying whatever we could of their supply line.
So all total, how many missions did you fly?
35.
You know right away.
Yeah. I was shot down once.
You were shot down, and tell us about that.
Well, this particular day, we went to a small town called Merseburg, which at that time, we had destroyed most of the German oil refineries. So they had come up with this concept of building synthetic gasoline from coal, and they had a lot of coal in their rural area. So this one town was producing about 30% of the synthetic oil, and it was obviously it was heavily defended. So as we approached the flak field, two of our engines were hit, and we couldn't sustain altitude, so we turned around, dropped our bombs, and headed east or west to get back to England.
As fast as you hopefully could.
And luckily for us, a B-51 came alongside to keep off the fighters. It turned out that we got to a point where the pilot said, look, he said, if you're going to bail out, you better bail out now because we're getting so low the chute won't open. So nobody bailed out for two reasons. One, we didn't want to be a prisoner of war. Mm-hmm. And secondly, we didn't want to be caught by the civilians.
Being caught by the civilians, talk about that a little bit.
Well, the problem was that they didn't like the airmen for what we were doing to their towns and cities. Mm-hmm. So if you did get captured by one, chances are they would either kill you on the spot, or they would have they'd take you into town and hang you from the town lamppost or something. Mm. And they always told us if you had to go down, the first thing you should try to do if you can't escape is go try to find a military man. If you can't find a military man, look for a policeman. If you can't find a policeman, look for a priest.
Anything except a civilian.
Anything to avoid a civilian. But luckily for us, we crash-landed in a former German airfield that the Americans had just taken over. But the pilot had really no chance. He just had to get down because the plane was so low and he couldn't control it much more. So we went off into a field and we destroyed the airplane, but nobody was seriously hurt. So
that was one of the lucky moments, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was my third mission. I had 32 more to go.
You had to get back up and do it. And Murray, you were fighting your war on the other side of the world. You were over in the Pacific. When did you join up?
42.
I wasn't
called until early 43, however. And I didn't want to be a walking soldier. I enlisted in the Army Air Corps. We trained in several different bases.
But then you got sent over into the Pacific.
Oh, I did, eventually.
And you were, what was your, you know, Bill was a navigator and you were?
Bombardier.
Yes.
Bombardier. Yeah, I was assigned to a crew and trained with them, went through what they call the phases, which, however, when we were, the phases were complete, they held all the bombardiers back and sent the crews to Italy without a bombardier. And from there, we ended up in the Pacific.
And where were you based?
Well, mainly we were on a small island called Morotai. It's down in the Dutch East Indies on a line halfway between the Philippines and Australia. It's a smaller island, but we had Australians on there. We had the 307th Bomb Group.
So while Bill was flying over Germany looking for refineries and trying to guide his plane there, you were dropping bombs where and what were your missions about?
Well, our missions were long, over water. We bombed a lot of things. One that I remember, it wasn't a nice one either, but it was a Japanese compound. That was our first mission, really. The others, a lot of them were just mop-up, you know, 500 pounds on a runway or something like that. We were kept busy, though, for 13 missions is all we ended up getting. There were four of us still alive.
From your crew.
On the crew out of 10.
We hear a lot about, Stephen Ambrose certainly popularized that term, Band of Brothers, when he was writing about the 101st Airborne Company that he profiled, and using that Shakespearean line. But it strikes me, having gotten a sense of how closely you veterans kept in touch with your mates, I mean, you know exactly where you're crews are, you get together for lunches with other flyboys.
Yeah.
That Band of Brothers is true, isn't it?
Yeah.
That here it is 70-some years later, and it's still a bond.
I think we have the one thing in common. All of us have been in some sort of combat. You know, we sit there and tell stories and compare notes, and Murray is an excellent master of ceremonies. He has all kinds of stories that help simulate the meeting and bring out jokes, or he'll bring in things that happened to him in the service. So it's just great to be with people your own age that have that common feeling of you did something for your country. And we have several people that aren't even veterans that come to our luncheon. Mm-hmm. Besides Brad and yourself, we have a couple other ladies. We have a sailor. We have a French Resistance fellow as part of our group. You know, whoever wants to come, it's open, and the guys just have fun getting together.
Brad, you began being involved some years ago. One of the ways was through something called Honor Flight Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
And you've taken it upon yourself to go on these flights, taking veterans like Bill and Murray to D.C. to visit the National World War II Memorial. But even more importantly, you seem to have a strong sense of wanting to capture through your photographs their stories so that the stories continue. Why is it so crucial to you to do this?
I think probably because younger generations are seeing a skewed version of it, and they see it through video games, movies, third, fourth, fifth-hand accounts, mm-hmm. instead of actually hearing it and seeing it for themselves. And it's a very difficult history to send out to the masses without it being diffused, I think. And so I found it fascinating to hear about the war simply because it was probably the most recent time when you could have an effect as one individual. And I was just always fascinated by that. And growing up, I knew about my own grandfather's history, but I never appreciated it because he didn't speak about it much. So by communicating this hopefully to younger generations while we still have our World War II vets, I found it very important to try to stoke a conversation between them. And hopefully they would realize that the guy sitting in the mall having an ice cream or having a coffee next to him or whatever might actually be somebody really interesting to speak with and communicate an actual true story, not just hear about it, read about it, or see it represented in a video game somewhere.
Murray and Bill, I know Tom Brokaw has given you and yours that title of the greatest generation. Was being great anything that crossed your mind while you were serving?
Oh, I don't think at the time, you know, we didn't think we were that great, of course. But we've been dubbed a lot of things, and thanks to our photographer here. He's the one that actually made us quite famous.
You know, we were just a small group of four elderly guys sitting together in a restaurant, you know, talking about our war experiences until Brad joined us. Mm. And then everything just exploded. I mean, we went to Honor Flight. He gave us the chance to ride this restored B-17 at Willow Ronda, which you were a part of. He's taken all kinds of portrait pictures of us. He's done all kinds of things to elevate us into a small little group of ho-hum guys into a big...
to guys that everybody cares about. And we've seen that with Saving Private Ryan came out in 98, and then, of course, the National World War II Memorial opens in 2004. Yeah. So take us back to the years before that. When you got home from the war, you got on with your lives, did you talk to your families much about your war experiences, or did you just carry on? Murray, you didn't?
No, not really. I was married during the war and had a son while I was overseas, mind you. I came home to a family, really. You know, I had a wife and a son and had a business to go to. We didn't do much talking about war. I mean, there have been times since where we've discussed things that have happened to each of us. A good friend of mine, Bert Miner, and I used to go to lunch. This is he was a member of the same Lions Club. Mm-hmm. And when we got to the retired age, we used to go to lunch together. And I got a card, I think, in the mail telling me about a World War II veteran who was a bombardier, by the way, and he was in B-24s, is going to give a talk up at the Birmingham Library. So I called my good friend Bert and said, come on, we got to go and hear this fellow. Well, as it turned out, he was not a bombardier. He was a navigator.
And he wasn't on a B-24.
He wasn't on B-24s. He had B-17s. But we invited him to lunch, too. And sometime between the date we'd set for our lunch, he met a fourth member. And so that's how the four of us got started. And but Bert is gone, and so is Stauffer. Mm-hmm. He was the fourth one.
I wonder if you could talk to the people who are listening, especially the younger people. Brad talked about the importance of getting a sense of the firsthand experience of being in World War II. We've seen TV shows. We've seen movies. How close is any of that to the real experience, Bill?
Well, the only, you know, from our standpoint, mm-hmm. I mean, Saving Private right. Ryan was a great movie. But the only one that I really respect as being very authentic was 12 O'Clock High. I mean, there's others like Pearl Harbor and
Memphis Belle. And
different ones that are too Hollywood. They don't even look alike. But 12 O'Clock High, they had the right equipment on. They had everything was so authentic that I was really impressed with how well they did that job.
Brad, I want to wrap up by asking you for your involvement in photographing these veterans and hearing their stories. What have you gotten out of this, and what do you hope that people who look at your photos of the veterans will get out of it?
I got a sense of closure, simply because it was a very, very important time in my life. I was on the roof of the Trade Center on the 10th, on September 10th, and that was my Pearl Harbor. The 11th was absolutely my generation's Pearl Harbor. I never understood what drove my grandfather to join December 8th, 1941. I finally understood it. I never served myself. I never joined the military. I haven't ever served in any capacity. This was my way of serving. And it allowed me to deal with, I guess, my own stress from being there during the attacks in New York, and find my own sense of camaraderie and brotherhood through these men, which I never got to experience through my grandfather until literally days before he died. He didn't share that information until right then. And here I get to revisit that whole concept and truly enjoy getting to know them not just as veterans but as individuals who I have a whole different respect for because of the way they conducted their lives after the war and what they did in the entire generation. So it's brought a lot of closure in many different capacities. And I would hope that younger generations right now can view photographs and realize that we can learn so much from them. But you just have to sit down and talk with them, and don't talk about the war necessarily. Don't go up to somebody who was a vet and ask them, did you ever kill anybody? But really have an honest conversation with them about what they did when they came home. How did they deal with stress? What did they do for education? How did they deal with their families? Did they tell them their stories? Mm-hmm. And once you forge that real relationship, you can begin to appreciate them not just as veterans but as common citizens.
We can say thank you to all of our veterans, everyone who is listening from all of the wars, with a special thanks to our veterans today, Bill Rosenai of Bloomfield Hills and Murray Cotter of Beverly Hills, Flyboys.
Yeah.
And Brad Ziegler, photographer. And we are going to be putting links on our stateside page at michiganradio.org to take you to some of the many photographs that Brad Ziegler has taken of Bill and Murray and the other Michigan World War II veterans. Also a link to Honor Flight Michigan. This was the group that was taking our veterans to visit their memorial in Washington. That has kind of moved into an effort to build a memorial to honor Michigan's World War II veterans to be built in Royal Oak, Michigan. And so you can find out more information on that as well. Thanks for joining us today on Stateside.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Cindy.
And if you have a parent, grandparent, or a loved one who fought in World War II, you can have a paver stone with his or her name placed on it in the future memorial to Michigan's World War II vets. And you can find out more about this legacy project to build the memorial by going to honorflightmichigan.com, and we have that link on our stateside page at michiganradio.org.